Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and it's been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week I speak to Chris Jones, who's disabled and having terrible trouble with the Department for Work and Pensions, where he lives near Merthyr Tydfil in Wales. Also, the book The Leveller Revolution by John Rees is just out, about the English Civil War, which, funnily enough, we don't get taught properly about in our schools. Caroline Lamb interviews me about that. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street, and I'll give proper contact details at the end of the show.
My name's Christopher Jones, and I'm in a little village called Nelson, which is on the outskirts of Merthyr Tydfil in South Wales.
How did you come to be living there?
I recently split up with my girlfriend. We hadn't long had a baby, and I fought for custody of my son. I went through quite a lot of problems while I was fighting for custody of my son, and the police ended up getting me a house here in the village, which is probably about 5 miles away from my village where I was born in. Like,
okay, so tell us about the village. What does it look like? What's there? What kind of facilities?
It's just a little village you drive through, really. There's a little bus station, quite a few takeaways and shops. There's a supermarket and a petrol station, but it's just a little village in between Pontypridd and Merthyr Tydfil.
Tell us a bit about your background, where you were brought up, your father's work, that sort of thing.
Well, all my family, to be honest with you, they love their work. I was brought up in a little village called Flamborough. I had a brilliant childhood. My father worked for the government in the atomic weapons establishment all his life. He had early redundancy because they shut the factory and made everyone redundant and moved the factory up to all the shops.
Okay, where was that?
He worked in Cardiff, atomic weapons establishment.
Okay, what about your health? Because I know a few years ago you had a few problems with your health. Just tell us how that happened, where it happened, etc.
I was working in a company in Ashburnach. I was a store person. I was unloading a wagon. I got to the last pallet, which was right at the back of the wagon. Now, the company was supposed to supply a harness to tie around the mast, or connect the mast and tie around the base of the pallet. You could drag it out with a fork truck, but they didn't, so I had to do it manually. I did it, no problem. I'll be honest with you, I got to the end of the truck. But as soon as I stood up, I felt this almighty pain go right up my back. My hips gave way, and I fell off the back of the wagon. It took me about 15, 20 minutes, to be honest with you, screaming for help in a puddle before someone came to help me. But they took me to the hospital. I had x-rays, and all they could see was a slight kink in my spine at the time. Since then, I had an MRI scan, and they seen that I had herniated discs.
Now, what company were you working for? Because that does sound like negligence by your employer, really.
In all fairness, sorry to interrupt, but the company did pay me out £4,500 for negligence.
Right.
Because they admitted the fault, and they knew that I'd had injury because I'd been to the hospital.
But, I mean, that's set you on a road of sickness, possibly for the rest of your life, you know. So who was the firm?
Bergstrom in Ashburnach. They're a worldwide firm. They build air conditioning units for JCBs and things like that, Lotus cars.
Okay, so anyway, what happened with, because obviously, you know, with that sort of injury, you may be able to claim benefits or sickness benefits. So what happened with your benefits?
Well, I'd be honest with you, I struggled for 2 years trying to stay in work because, I've been brought up, my family all worked. I mean, my father's nearly 18, he's getting up 4 o'clock every morning now, going to work 7 days a week. Mostly to try and support me, to be honest with you, but I worked probably in about 6 or 7 different jobs before I went on sickness benefit because my doctor suggested that I went on it because every time I was trying to work and then getting sacked, I was getting in debt because I wasn't getting benefits for 6 weeks.
Well, tell me, why is that? Why were you getting sacked?
because obviously I couldn't get up some mornings just because I got too many discs. I suffer, so I had to get pretty much 24/7 now. And some days I can't even move out of bed to get to the phone to ring into work and say, look, I can't come into work.
Well, it sounds to me like an open and shut case now that you're disabled, so you should just simply be getting the benefits for a disabled person without any real question.
Well, I have been since 1997, on and off, but it seems every 18 months to 2 years, they send you out the health assessment, you've got to go for it, you go for it, and they're purposely designed to take you off benefits. I mean, I've been reading the reports, because the report they sent me for this assessment is utterly bogus, because questions they claim they asked me and answers they claimed I'd given, I didn't give, because they didn't ask me then questions.
So
it's obvious to me that before you even go to the assessment, they're looking out for reasons to stop you getting your benefit. And I understand this because they get a £1,500 bonus for everyone they sign off. I don't know if that's true, but it's what I've read and what I've been told.
Well, I mean, that just sounds appalling. I mean, you're in the situation where you've been doing these assessments. What's your experience of actually, you know, what happens when you go for one?
Well, I'll be honest with you. Each time I've gone for one, I have asked for a GP or approve a medical professional to do it, because I understand it's physiotherapists that actually do it, the health assessment. And my experience is of them is you've got to, they expect you to be 100% honest with them. And as soon as you are, they put you down for it. Because I've been honest and I've said, look, out of 365 days in a year, I'd say 50 of them, I'm probably all right, and I suffer 2 to 3 out of ping. Out of 10 ping. But because you say that, they mark you 2 to 3 out of 10 ping all your life. So they think you can do everything every day. It doesn't work like that. I know for a fact now that if I was to go for a job, I'd be sacked within 3 or 4 days. And I'd be surprised if any company would insure me to work for their company because of the amount of drugs I'm on.
And what about actually getting a job with that level of being disabled?
That's another thing. They say people don't discriminate, but they do. I think a lot of the problems with people discriminating against people with illnesses usually is down to the government, because the government try and make everyone believe that it's the disabled and the sick that's draining the state. But I know for a fact that the government have wasted over £1 million worth of taxpayers' money trying to get me off this benefit since 1997, yet I earn a fraction of that in my lifetime off benefit.
So, I mean,
how can they justify spending so much money to get me off one single benefit?
Are you entitled to some sort of compensation for your injury at work?
I did receive a £4,500 compensation payment off them, but I was told by a solicitor the last time I was thrown off the ESA, who got me onto the severe disability payment, because the DWP didn't inform me of that, and he informed me that I should be on an industrial injuries payment. And when I queried about that, he explained to me that from the day I had the injury, I'm entitled to an industrial injuries payment because the company was liable for the accident. So I applied to the Industrial Injuries Board and I went for an assessment. Before I went for the assessment, they asked what happened and they said, yeah, you do qualify, you just need to go for an assessment and then they'll work out how much money per week you're entitled to because of your accident. So I went for the assessment, and then a couple of weeks later I had a letter back saying that I didn't qualify, as they didn't feel that the accident caused any problems in my daily living. So then I rung them up and I asked them to justify how they can pay me ESA, personal independence payment, and severe disability payment for the same reasons, but state that it doesn't affect me for my industrial injuries payment. And it's been worked out that they owe me around about £46,000 since 1997.
Tell us a bit about your daily regime, the situation, the kind of, you know, ability to look after yourself. Because obviously, you know, in your situation, if someone that isn't as able-bodied as most of the rest of us are, I mean, you have all sorts of different pressures on your life that other people don't.
Well, I think not that it's any sort of excuse or anything, but being a single dad, I've taken its toll on me, to be honest with you, because obviously when my son was young, I've had to bend down a lot, bathing him and catching him when he's falling over and things like that. And I think that have taken its toll and have affected me more. These days, all I tend to do now is I don't go to bed because I can very rarely get up there, and there's no point because I don't sleep. So I stay downstairs most of the night trying to watch something on the internet or something, YouTube. And my son gets up, I take him to school, I come back, I lie on the sofa all day, face down, until I pick him up, because it's the least amount of pain I go through. And this causes its own problems, because I'm not sure I've had 2 or 3 clocks in my lungs in the last 3 years. And they've said it's because of lack of exercise and that. But I've also got a muscle disorder, whereas when I use my muscles, they take a lot longer than normal to recover, and they ache for a long time. Which obviously with sciatica, the arthritis in my ankles, my wrists, I got it throughout my body. Like, I'm just constantly in pain.
So what's your situation now? Are you getting these benefits for your disability? I mean, you obviously are disabled.
No. I haven't had no money off them now since November. I do get my personal independence payment every 4 weeks. But I don't see much of that because obviously I've got bills going out direct debit every week, which I need to pay. They don't obviously realise that for the amount of years I've been on this benefit, I've also got commitments that I've got bills to pay. And they just cut you off straight away and they will not talk to you about it. And an appeal, I think the last appeal took me either 10 or 18 months. I can't remember. One took me 10 months and one took me 18 months.
So are you able to get your son to school okay and do basic things like feed him, feed yourself?
No, I haven't eaten a hot meal or anything hot for 11 days. I've had to go up to school and tell the school that I've got to swap schools because my son's got to go and live with his mother because when I won custody of my son, it was part of a court order. I got to get him back and forth school every day and back and forth his mother's because obviously she don't live by us and she don't drive. Obviously, I'm not getting no money now, so I can't pay the insurance on my car. I can't get him back for school, so the school have phoned social services asking them if there's anything they can do to help, because my son is 7 years old, and he's been given homework set for 12-year-olds in comprehensive school, because he's doing so good in our school. And the teacher's concerned that if he does go, it's going to affect his future, because he's doing so well, and everyone loves him in the school, do you know what I mean? He's such a polite, loving, caring boy. He gets on with everyone, and I'm fearful that it's going to affect his future, because after all, the only reason I'm here doing this is for him.
I mean, it sounds as if these decisions that which are being made by the Department of Work and Pensions and the private businesses that they employ are actually really detrimental to your son and to his future.
I obviously won custody of my son because back then his mother and the boy she was with, they weren't doing the best. But I mean, I can't take away from them. They're brilliant now. They're brilliant parents and they helped me out a lot. And I'll be honest with you, they're the only people I got. I've been so angry at the way the DWP have treated me over the years, and the fact I haven't had a local GP for 2.5 years. Do you know what I mean? I've got to travel 30 minutes to see a GP, yet the Independent Police Complaints Commission have proved that the doctor and the health board have got no evidence to back up their claims that I threatened the doctor, which I didn't. These claims 2 weeks after I made a complaint to the health board about him, 2 weeks after I made the complaint, he claims I threatened him over the phone. There's no proof or evidence, and yet, even though there's no proof and evidence, I haven't been at a local GP for 2.5 years, yet I've got all these conditions, and they expect me to drive 30 minutes to go and see a GP and then get turned down meds, because the first 2 times I went there I was turned down meds, and that put me on. I had to go look for cannabis then to try and help me with my pain. I got emphysema. I've been laid down all over the board. Like,
it just sounds to me as if you're becoming more and more isolated.
I don't see anyone at all. I've pushed everyone away. I don't even get on my parents anymore. I mean, and it's affecting everything to do with my life, to be honest with you. I had the police here last week. They wanted to sign me into the local mental hospital because they were pretty sure I was going to do something stupid. But lucky enough, I managed to get onto the mental health crisis team, who let the police know that I have got an appointment with them, and it's in my best interest, really, that the police leave me alone, because I'm not a threat to myself. So that was a good thing that I managed to ring him, otherwise I'd be locked up in a mental hospital, no?
How do you think it would be, what would be the simplest way to sort your situation out and make life livable again?
I think the DWP should 100% change the way they do things, do you know what I mean? I'm pretty sure the big people in the DWP, even though the staff who answer the phones know they're affecting people's lives in such a way that it must be affecting theirs. Because I could never go into a job knowing that I'm going to affect someone's life the way they're affecting mine, day in, day out, because that's what they're doing. There should be a policy where I can contact someone and say, look, can you please explain to me how a decision maker can overturn 3 sick notes from a GP and a personal letter explaining that I've got serious mobility issues because of my lower back problems, I've got inhalers for my emphysema, I've got pain throughout my body because of my arthritis, and I've got appointments to see all these specialists, yet they ignore it all. So there should be someone we can go to say, look, this is affecting my life. It needs sorting out today or tomorrow, not in 8 weeks or 16 months' time.
Now, I mean, it just sounds almost as if there's a kind of viciousness and cruelty to the way you're being treated. How do you cope with that?
I don't, to be honest with you. I lock myself away, and I'm like, my son goes up to his mother as if I got him here, and if he stays with me, the plan was, when I won custody of him, we'd have him half a week, as long as she lived by the rules, and she did, and she got brilliant, so she has him half a week, but whenever he's up there over the weekends, all I do is lie in bed with a quilt over my head. Because I'm scared to go out and go to a shop and that, because even if I go to a shop and someone looks at me going, oh, I feel everyone's judging me all the time.
I mean, it just sounds very strange when a doctor is saying one thing and the people are just trying to cut you off from benefits. What do you think they're actually trying to do?
I actually think they're trying to kill me through stress and anxiety. Because I don't know why, but I feel that they believe what the government's telling them, and they think that it's people like us who want benefits that are draining the state, but it's not. It's the government trying to chuck us off because it costs them 10 times more money than we'll ever have in a lifetime of one benefit for them to chuck us off, because I'm sure they've wasted over £1 million of the taxpayers' money trying to get me off a benefit where I get about 100 grand in a lifetime. Mate.
I mean, it sounds almost as if they're treating you worse than an animal. You know, how does that affect your life?
It's affected me in every way, to be honest with you. I've got no confidence. I'll be honest with you, I'm not a girlfriend in years and years and years, because I can't. I don't want to drag anyone else down, do you know what I mean? I've been dragged down so much that people around me, my family, people I used to talk to on Facebook, I think they've just unfriended me because they're fed up of feeling the anguish that I'm going through, because, do you know what I mean, they're so frustrated that people are allowing me to keep going through this.
How would you like this to finish? How would you like it to sort itself out? What would you like to see happen?
I don't know if this is on air and someone that is in a position that may be able to offer some help or advice can contact you or me and try and sort it out with the DWP. I would very much appreciate if the Health Secretary of Wales, who I contacted, Vaughan Gething, I think it is, isn't it? I was told to contact him by my AM because he understands that Vaughan Gething is the only person that could probably contact the DWP and get him to overturn such a ridiculous decision. I sent him an email and had a response saying that he can't help him.
Well, what about your MP?
I've got an assembly member, I forget his name now, sorry, local one from Newbridge, Clyde Cymru one. He's going to help me with the appeal. But like you said, the appeal process with the DWP takes absolutely ages. So he's asked me to get confirmation from social services. They supplied me with adaptations to my house, which I've got. He's asked me to get another letter from my GP explaining that they're causing me mental health issues as well as other health issues, which he's going to be ringing me tomorrow to sort out, because obviously I'm part of a safe agent scheme. He's not a local GP. I'm only allowed to see him on a Thursday. So, do you know what I mean? I've just got to wait, and that's the problem with the DWP, and everything seems to be such a long process to be able to get anywhere. You can't overturn a decision that's wrong for months and months and months with them, and it affects your life in the meantime, and they don't care. Like,
so have you got some sort of appeal running now?
I've got to put an appeal in. They told me, I'll be honest with you, I rang the DWP up and I explained that I felt the assessment they gave me was a bit bogus, because the questions that they've asked me, they didn't ask me, and the answers they say I give, I didn't give. And I explained that my doctor has given me another sick note because he doesn't believe I should be taken off. And they suggested that I put a fresh claim in. So I put a fresh claim in, and that's why they're turning down the sick notes now, because they are saying that there's no new condition in the sick notes. And I'm explaining to them that they told me that if I can prove that my condition have got worse or I've got a new condition, then I can go back on the benefit. So the sick notes the doctor have given them are proving that my conditions have got worse, but they're just refusing to take them or accept them. So I don't know where to go from here, because I can't have no... There's a discretionary assistance fund you can have a loan from. Now, you can only have three of them in 18 months, and I've had three in the last 18 months, and they only had to give you £60 a time. So they expect me now, for the £180 I've had in the last 18 months, they'll ask me until this appeal goes, and they don't, like, do you know what I mean?
I mean, if you could speak directly to whoever's in charge of the DWP or the Prime Minister or whatever, what would you say to them, Chris?
Oh, I would love to have a little sit-down meeting with them and explain what they're doing to people and explain a better way of going around it, because training, I understand there's a lot of benefit sheets out there. It's very rare you'll see me using my crutches. A long time ago, I would use them, but it's caused me so many problems with arthritis in my elbows, my wrists and my ankles, because I've got to put my weight on different sides of my body when I'm getting a sciatic in different sides. When I go to these assessments, I'm 100% honest, and I tell them. Training, there's 1 or 2 days... Do you know what I mean? You might be able to see me walking out the street or kicking the ball with my son. But I'll come in an half hour later, I'm on the bed and I can't get off of it for a good 12 or 14 hours. Do you know what I mean? Because it affects me straight away as soon as I do these things. There's better ways of going around things, and I think the government need to stop looking after themselves and looking after the people that put them in power in the first place.
Well, they'll probably say is that you probably didn't vote for them in the first place. But also, they're trying to save money, Chris, aren't they?
Well, yeah. What reason are they trying to save money for, though? I can't understand, because their job is to help the British public. They seem to be helping themselves and other publics around the world instead of us. Everything comes out of a Tory's MP's mouth, I just think, is a lie. And it's designed to, I don't know, they seem to tell us lies, make us promises, and they never ever back anything up, do they? I don't think they ever, they?
Okay.
And it's the same with most politicians these days. I've got to be honest, I've spoken to quite a few, and I get on with them because I got true faith that they do want to change things, and I believe that when politicians want to be a politician, they do want to change things, but I think there's so much corruption in government these days. It's going down into businesses and everything around Britain, because everyone's fed up with the government getting away with it, so they try their best to get away with it as well. And a lot of people are getting away with it.
So what's the attitude of your doctor when he finds that the officials are just ignoring what he's saying about your condition?
He can't believe that he's trained like 14 years to get to his qualifications, and in his words, a pen pusher behind the desk ridicules it all. That's what he said. A pen pusher behind the desk says that I'm not qualified to tell you that you can work or not. Yet they can. That's why he wrote the letter.
Anyway, Chris, keep in touch with us and let's follow your case. So if there's any developments over the next few months, let us know. And let's hope that you get your tens of thousands of pounds that these people owe you, so you can start to do things like... get insurance for your car, you know, and take your son to school.
Tony, I'll be honest with you, mate, I don't want the 40-odd grand. If they were willing to say, look, do you know what I mean? We'll put you back in the ESA, you're never going to have the money we owe you for industrial injuries, but we'll give you the 30 or 40 quid a week from now on that you're entitled to for you. I'd be well happy with that. All I want to do is bring my son up and see my other son as much as I can, but my other son lives about 20 miles away from me, and obviously I haven't seen him since before Christmas. Because of these sanctions, like, I didn't even have a Christmas. I haven't had a penny off ESA since the end of November.
Okay, well, look,
they won't let me claim that, what's it called now, Universal Credit, because I'm fighting the case. And the last time they chucked me off, I went to sign on Job Seekers Allowance. They wouldn't let me sign on Job Seekers Allowance because they said I was unable to work. Because I got my hair off and a job centre saying, well, how am I going to get any money? I raised my voice, they phoned the police on me and banned me from the job centre.
Yes, we'll follow you over the next months and just stay in touch, Chris, will you?
I will, and I want to thank you and your team because, I'll be honest with you, it seems to be you the only person who's listened to me, and I really appreciate it because just someone listening can lift a depression mood out of you, do you know what I mean? It really helps being able to talk to someone.
Well, let's just hope that the DWP start to listen too, Chris.
Yeah, I just hope that the public get wise and stop, do you know what I mean, making people like me feel too ashamed to go out because it's a lot to do with the public as well. The public is sucked in by all these propaganda and lies the government chuck out.
Into the future. You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
So it's a new book that's just been published titled The Leveller Revolution. It's a book about the English Civil War. I'm Caroline Lamb and Dialect's Tony Gosling is here with me to talk about it. So first, if I look at the cover, I can see that there's a quote which I can't interpret too well myself, but it says, "I think that the poorest he that is in England hath a life to live as the greatest he." Could you maybe elaborate on that?
Yeah, I certainly can. I mean, that is a quote from the Putney debates. The Putney debates were at the heart of the English Civil War, really, and they were where there was a decision after the king had his head chopped off, and people were saying, well, okay, so what happens now? And so they decided to bring a whole load of people from around the country, particularly active politically and people who had big ideas about what the Civil War should kind of what should materialise after the Civil War, brought them to Putney Church, and they had discussions and debates at the end of the Civil War about what was going to happen, because there was a major problem. There was no real plan. And you could probably say this, or a lot of people do say the same about Brexit, you know, well, they've decided to do this, but no one knows how it's actually going to work. And so they got rid of the king. The king had his head chopped off, Charles I, and there wasn't any kind of real settlement as to how the country should be run. And the debates were part of that. But this was a statement by one of the people at the Putney debates, which was to say, look, everybody in the country deserves to be part of the government in some way, or to be talked about, rather than just continue with the old system, which had been the feudal system, you know, from the king down, big dukes, landowners, and down to the smallest person. And that they saw the idea of levelling, and that's what the levellers were, as very important, that, you know, everybody was as important as everybody else. And so they wanted to get rid of partly of the class system, I suppose, you know, the feudal class.
So that's a pretty good introduction then. So maybe if we take it back to the basics, who were the levellers?
Well, the levellers, yeah, as I said, were to do with the idea being levelling. They actually started in the army, because there were a lot of discussions amongst the army about the rights and wrongs. And we're talking about the parliamentary side here. Of what they were doing, because obviously they're killing a lot of their fellow countrymen. We had something like 20% of people in Britain died in the English Civil War between the early 1640s and the late 1640s. So it was, there was a lot of questions amongst the army, like, why are we killing our own countrymen? So there was a natural kind of discussion and debate amongst the soldiers. And that's where the levellers really first started. They started electing, and they demanded this from the army chiefs, electing soldiers to sit on the army council. So every regiment would have one soldier who was a representative of all the soldiers in the regiment, who had a voice at the army council amongst all the senior officers deciding what the army was going to do. Now, I'm not saying that the other people like Cromwell didn't meet privately and have their own ideas. But the idea was that Cromwell was trying to carry the army with him, because it would be likely, as did actually happen, that the army would mutiny because they were being told to do things they just simply didn't agree with.
Okay, so there's a part in the book as well about printing and the role that that played.
Well, very important as well. And the levellers weren't just soldiers. I mean, there were a lot of people in the country that supported the leveller movement, and also writers like Richard Overton. There are several writers. Also, we can't really talk about levellers without mentioning this guy, John Lilburn. He was a lieutenant colonel in the army, and he was, would you say, a bit of a rebel, I suppose. He would challenge Cromwell quite a lot. In fact, he would condemn him publicly, and when it looked like Cromwell didn't want to hear what he had to say, he would then go around writing pamphlets. And again, printing was very important. Up until the Civil War, printing had been completely controlled by print guilds. So that is to say, the, you know, the sort of what we now have as the Guildhall in London, with all the companies of various things like the Clothiers Company and all these. It's a very strange sort of Masonic kind of thing that they have in the City of London. But they were like little mini trade unions or closed shops. And the printers were only allowed to print things that they were licensed to be printed. And the forces behind the civil war on both sides, the royalists and the roundheads, both of them tried to control the presses by licensing. So what happened was, guess what? The presses were so-called liberated, so they would be pinched and taken and stuff would be secretly printed and distributed around the country. So it was the first time you'd ever had really free... It was almost like, I suppose a modern equivalent would be something like pirate radio, where they weren't supposed to be doing it, but they were doing it anyway. And of course, if you ever go to places like the Bodleian Library in Oxford or the British Library, you can find some absolutely amazing pamphlets that were printed at the time. By the levellers, largely by levellers, and other groups like ranters and diggers and Anabaptists. There were all sorts of groups that appeared. Like, we think that this is what this is all about, the Civil War was all about. And in fact, some of them have things like at the bottom, printed in a corner of freedom, close by the House of Commons, you know. Well, so they were very much aware that what they were doing was dangerous, yeah, you know, and but important. I mean, nowadays, if you talk to any, you know, sort of senior, serious military people, I mean, you won't get this on the BBC, but they'll tell you that about 80% of modern warfare is information warfare. It's psychological warfare to do with largely through the mainstream press, even through books, magazines, that sort of thing. You know, influencing people's minds to like or dislike one side or another side. 15% of modern warfare is economic warfare, and only 5% is military, you know, where you're actually fighting. So this 80% of modern warfare being about, you know, about influencing people, about the media, effectively, psychological, it was very much in play in the Civil War, because the pamphlets did affect people a lot, and the people would risk their lives to get information out to the public about what was really going on.
Interesting parallels. The likes of WikiLeaks.
Yes, exactly, come to mind. Yeah. And being locked up in the Ecuadorian embassy.
So another point to mention would maybe the role of the church.
Well, very important, yeah, because at the time, it was about 100 years after the Reformation, Martin Luther and the Protestants kind of starting out in Germany, and then they kind of, there was the Presbyterians and various other forms of these Lutheran churches, Protestant churches. Now, they were having a go at the Latin Church, the Catholic Church, but of course they had their own failings, so it was a kind of stupid debate where, you know, you're saying that our version of Christianity is better than your version, and by the way, if you don't do it the way we say, we're going to lock you up. Well, of course, that isn't very Christian in itself. So you've got this silly kind of conflict going on. Priests, the Catholic priests having to hide in priest holes. That was this era. The gunpowder plot was a bit before this. But, you know, these sorts of big events where, oh, the Catholics are trying to destroy the country. They'd have this quite a lot. So this was the backdrop to it all. And actually, Charles I was very sensible about all this. He was being bamboozled by the merchant classes across the country and by others to say, oh, no, we're going to ban the Catholic Church completely. But he didn't really want to do that. And that was one of the reasons that they went for him, is because he refused to go along with it all. And in fact, Archbishop Laud, there was a whole succession before the Civil War broke out of people like the Archbishop, who actually was from Gloucester originally, a very good Archbishop, but he was beheaded by Parliament, effectively, you know. And there was a load of people that didn't agree with the Protestants were beheaded, and they're supposed to be, you know, nicer than the Catholics. It's really, the whole thing is a whole... And the other thing was that to do with Scotland, that there was an attempt to enforce a new prayer book on the Scots, which really backfired as well. So this whole kind of conflict between the Catholics and the Protestants was almost a little bit like a sort of almost a mini Northern Ireland kind of thing, right, breaking out, because the extremists on both sides weren't actually Christians. They were doing their own. Had their own axe to grind of one sort or another, and they weren't showing any kind of love and compassion at all. They just seemed to be focusing on the differences between the different sorts of beliefs rather than the similarities, which were much bigger. And, you know, you have to see it on the backdrop of, well, yes, the roundheads, the parliamentarians were Protestant, but after the Civil War and the Restoration, after the Civil War, everything just sort of went back to normal, really. Well, we'll tolerate both Catholics and Protestants, and so it was all for nothing, in a way.
So there was renewed interest in the Civil War after World War II. Do you have any information about any of that?
Well, definitely, yeah, there was. And I think it was partly because of World War II and the suffering of World War II and the particular pernicious evil of the Nazis. People sort of started re-examining history a little bit to say, look, what on earth is, you know, where do these kind of strange, difficult influences come from? And there was also an expanding of culture and a more interest in who are the English, who are these people that took on Hitler supposedly in 1939 when no one else wanted to. And so Christopher Hill was one. There was another guy called N.H. Brailsford that really started going through all these old pamphlets from the Civil War. And it's almost sort of discovering people like the Levellers almost for the first time. I mean, they had been known about, but they went into all these original pamphlets. They started digging out all sorts of other information about who they were, what their motivation had been, and brought it to the public at large in the 1940s and 1950s, particularly with Christopher Hill's book, The World Turned Upside Down. And that was really saying, well, actually, this is what we want to do. We want the rich to go down and the poor to be in charge, you know. So that was, in a way, what the Levellers were trying to do, was to actually get things level. They didn't want to totally turn things upside down. You might say they wanted to turn them halfway upside down,
even things out.
Yeah,
right. So there was a lesser talked about military dictatorship after the Civil War.
This is Cromwell, you see, because he won. And as I said at the Putney debates, there had been all this discussion about the way they were going to do things, and they still didn't really come to any proper conclusions after Putney. And so for 10 years, Britain had a military dictatorship with Cromwell in charge most of the time. And and it was totally unsatisfactory because these soldiers had complete arbitrary rule. The country was in a terrible state after the Civil War anyway, with a lot of people hungry, many starved. And it wasn't really appropriate to have these soldiers going around just simply telling everybody what to do. And as a result, the Civil War finished in 1649 with Charles I being beheaded. And it wasn't until 1650 was the beginning of the dictatorship. And it was another 10 years. So from 1650 till 1660, pretty much. And Cromwell died halfway along the road. Anyway, his son, Richard Cromwell, supposedly took over. But the only thing is, he just wasn't up to the job. And they asked Cromwell to be king. You know, he said, no, I would never be king. And yet he didn't really know what to do. So there was a power vacuum, I suppose you'd say. Mm. And what they did is they actually invited Charles I's son to come back, who managed to escape on the run, actually coming through Bristol and going through Lee Court in order to get across to France. And in exile, it was at the time Cromwell's soldiers were after him to possibly behead him too, but he managed to escape to France. And that by 1660, they were begging him to come back. And he did come back, and that's where we get the Restoration. And a big increase. I mean, one of the things Cromwell was doing was stopping all the theatres, so none of the theatres were allowed. You weren't allowed to dance, this sort of thing. There was loads of, a bit like ISIS in a way, you know. There was this kind of really, really super strict form of the religion. Mm. And once Charles II was back, that was all relaxed. So the theatres were all back open again, and there was what we call Restoration comedies. Now, I'd recommend it if anyone's never seen one of these or read it. The Restoration comedies are some of the funniest things you'll ever see. They're quite bawdy, you know, you might say sexist, but there is, you know, all sorts of ample opportunity of the women having a go at the men too. But a lot of it is quite clear. People were just relishing the fact that they could get back on the stage and there was freedom of drama again, and using it to have a right good laugh.
Any particular recommendations?
Oh, dear. I think Dryden was one of the writers at the time. He was a poet. I can't remember names of specific dramatists, but there are a whole load of them. And, you know, the best thing to do if you're interested in any of this is to just get hold of one of the collections of Restoration comedies.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Bristol just before.
Lee Court was where Charles II came through Bristol because he wanted, I mean, the thing is, he was on the run with two or three of his friends and in disguise, and he managed to make it down from Worcester all the way down through Cirencester and into Bristol, and he said, and they were saying to him, no, don't go to Bristol because you might get spotted by, you know, and arrested. Well, he said, no, I want to go and have a look at the defences of Bristol because, you know, Prince Rupert, who was defending it, he told him something about it. I'm not sure exactly what, but he was sort of quite brazen about his disguise being really good, and he could go to these places. He wasn't afraid, and he certainly was. He was totally fearless. So he came through Bristol. He went down to eventually towards Bridport to try and get a ship across to France. Mm-hmm. And what happened was he was due to get this ship early in the morning, and the ship never turned up. And it turned out that the captain's wife had locked in the captain, thinking he was going out smuggling. So he then had to go on the run again, and he made it off across to Brighton and eventually to France. But he was there for 10 years or so, and then eventually got asked to come back and take over again. But then that was only for a few decades, because then they had the thing called the Glorious Revolution, where they brought William and Mary over to take over from the Stuarts, and that was the end of the Stuart line. And they were very much more pro-Protestant, anti-Catholic. They went over to put down the Irish. So it was a resumption of the hideous, horrible attacks on the Irish Catholics, you know, that happened in the Civil War and then happened afterwards, which are still remembered in Irish history today.
In light of the Women's March that we just saw recently, there's quite a role to play for a women's rights movement in the Civil War.
I mentioned John Lilburn. He was this lieutenant colonel in the Parliamentary Army. His wife, Elizabeth Lilburn, was really the leader of the Leveller Women, and she was demanding the vote for women, all sorts of things, during the Civil War, which didn't really come until the 1800s. And they put together a massive petition, which a vast proportion, it was mostly the London women, signed, brought it to Parliament, and the Parliament wouldn't even accept the petition. They said that you can go away and wash the dishes. So that was the attitude of Parliament at the time to that. But wow. The Levellers were really one of the first proper women's rights movements we've ever had in Britain.
That's so interesting. It's a really important part of history. So that's the end of the questions. I think that's an important piece of history, though, that you hear about not quite so much. We did try and get in touch with author John Rees about this, but...
Yeah, I mean, I contacted him about a month ago, and yes, he agreed to do the interview. The only thing is, when we actually were just about to get him on the line on Skype to do the interview, he seems to have just changed his mind at the last minute, which is a great pity, really. I mean, he's one of the conveners of the National Stop the War Coalition, and so I was a little bit concerned that he wasn't going to do the interview. So what he said basically was that as I had sent out a retweet at the weekend about the Women's March, which took place mainly in New York, referring to the fact that the co-chair of the Women's March was admitted that she'd worked for the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, and also that many of the sponsors of the Women's March were directly funded by George Soros and his Open Society Foundation, that made me a Trump supporter, and he wouldn't be interviewed by a Trump supporter. So that was a little bit of a peculiar thing to have as we were settling down, getting ready to interview John Rees. Then he decided that. Now, I think it's probably worth pointing out that the MI5, when the David Shaler and Annie Machon, the two MI5 officers that were blowing the whistle about the Gaddafi affair back in the 1990s, when they spoke to Mark Hollingsworth, and he wrote a book called Defending the Realm about the revelations of those two whistleblowers then, they actually said that there were 55 agents in the Socialist Workers Party, in the SWP, which of course is the main force behind the Stop the War Coalition. So it does make you wonder, you know, if the Stop the War Coalition is really going to stop the war when the main convener is prepared to not do an interview because you've criticised the Central Intelligence Agency and George Soros, who are both major perpetrators of war. So anyway, I just thought that was quite interesting that John Rees had said he would be happy to be interviewed, and so I've just tried to fill you in a little bit on why you might want to buy this new book called The Leveller Revolution by John Rees. That's all for this week, Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you could subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Chris Jones from Merthyr Tydfil. We'll be staying in touch with him to see how he gets on with his claim from the Department for Work and Pensions being disabled. Also, thanks to Caroline Lamb for interviewing me about the Leveller Revolution, which is the birth of capitalism. Hey, thanks, folks. Britain brought capitalism to the world. And also to studio engineer Dave Bazenko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. You can contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street, on prsc.org.uk. Also through Volunteering Bristol, 0117 989 7733. Online, that's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk. Or you can go to the national volunteering site, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. So, till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
Deep inside, frightened of this thing that I've become.